So thanks for the introduction, Cuong Quan, and I'd like to, of course, thank KATP for hosting the conference, and especially Lincoln and Paul and Raman and Suzanne for doing all the organization. I know it was a tremendous amount of work, but it's great to be here. So as Cuong Quan said, I'll be telling you today about experiments we've been doing over the last couple of years on laser cooling and slowing of diatomic molecules. Here's a quick outline of the talk. I'll spend a very short amount of time on overview and motivations for this crowd. Pretty much everyone knows the story. Tell you about our primary two results, which is transverse cooling of a molecular beam and longitudinal slowing of a beam. And then talk a little bit about what we're doing now, which is moving towards trapping of molecules based on laser cooling. So this is an adaptation of a figure that most of you have seen before from an article that Lincoln, Raman, June, and I wrote a couple of years ago. The main point here is that, as we know, there are many very diverse potential scientific applications for ultracold molecules, ranging from things like quantum information and simulation, various topics in quantum many-body physics, to chemistry, cold chemistry, and precision measurements and tests of fundamental symmetries. And for these different applications, there tends to be different needs in terms of the phase space density of the samples. Quantum information and simulation, for example, require phase space density at or near the quantum degenerate regime, whereas things like precision measurements often don't need such high phase space density. But by contrast, some of these applications require large samples of molecules, such as precision measurements, where you're limited by statistics. In addition, the types of molecules that are needed for different applications are quite different. So for many applications, such as certain applications in many-body physics, quantum simulation, all you really need is structureless dipoles to get the strong electric dipole-dipole interaction between molecules. But for certain other things, such as variance on quantum information, simulation of quantum magnetic systems, it's useful to think about having molecules with unpaired electron spins. Of course, if you're trying to do chemistry, you'd like to be able to produce ultracold samples that are chemically diverse. And finally, for precision measurements and tests of fundamental symmetries, you often need the species, the right species, that has the optimal sensitivity to the effect you're trying to study. So all these things mean that the field is going to need many different methods to produce these very different sorts of molecules at high phase space density. So, of course, we know that one of the techniques that's proven very successful, we'll hear a little bit about this from June in the next talk, is essentially assembling molecules from ultracold atoms. And this gives rise to almost structureless dipoles, though the hyperfine structure in these molecules is important. Then there's also a set of techniques such as buffer gas cooling, stark magnetic and optical deceleration of beams, which are give access to a much broader range of molecular species, but until recently had given much lower phase space densities. But what I'll be talking about, at least part of several talks that we'll hear over the week, is methods to augment these things like buffer gas cooling or stark deceleration and move towards higher phase space densities through methods like sympathetic cooling. And that question mark was supposed to be erased since the Gila group has now seen that this works. Or sorry, evaporative cooling. There we go. That question mark did get erased. And then I'll tell you about laser cooling, where now our group, the Gila group, and the group at MPQ in Garching has also seen laser cooling of molecules. So in our experiments, we start with a new technology for making molecular beams. We started down this road collaborating with John Doyle nearly a decade ago, but the really key advance was made by John and his postdoc, Dave Patterson, where they showed that it's possible to create a cryogenic amoeba molecules with an extremely high flux. I won't spend much time on this, but the bottom line is that this way of making molecular beams has given us a brightness, a flux divided by divergence, which is roughly 1,000 times larger than comparable sources for any sort of molecule that you can't get in a bottle in gas form. things that, that come in gas form in bottles are easier to make beams of, but the kind of molecules that I'll be talking about, you can't do that. And I'll tell you about experiments using strontium fluoride, but we've now used these for many different molecules. So our experiments with laser cooling use the molecule strontium fluoride, and this was chosen to deal with one of the issues that was known to be a problem for laser cooling molecules, which is branching into different vibrational states. It was pointed out by Mike DeRosa about a decade ago that there are a reasonable handful of molecules where the Frank-Condon factors mean that the decays from the lowest vibrational level into excited vibrational levels are small enough that you can handle them. And in particular, for strontium fluoride, we can scatter more than 10 to the fifth photons by having a single cycling laser from the lowest vibrational level of the ground state to the lowest vibrational level of the first excited state, and two repumping lasers. And that's enough to scatter 10 to the fifth photons, which is enough to do essentially everything you need for laser cooling. I'll point out that in our scheme, the vibrational repumping from the first vibrational level proceeds through the same vibrational level as the cycling transition, where the repumping from the second level proceeds through an excited level. And we'll see why this is important in a second. But I'll maybe just mention that this was, I think, what many of us felt was always the key problem in laser cooling of molecules, was handling the branching into vibrational states. But it turns out that, in fact, it's not that bad. There are now something like a couple of dozen species identified where two or three repumping lasers is sufficient to close the cycle. That's proved to not be such a big issue. What's strangely proven to be a bigger issue is handling rotational branching. So the general strategy was really pointed out, at least people that made me aware of it, were this paper by Ben Stuhl and company from Junyi's group at JILA. It pointed out that in many molecules, if you just use angular momentum selection rules, by choosing the right sort of transition, you can get a transition which is rotationally closed. So here, for example, this shows a transition from a J equals 1 state to a J equals 0 state. Just from ordinary selection rules, this one can only decay back to J equals 1, and you have a cycle that's rotationally closed. So the price that you pay for this is that any transition like this from 1 to 0 has dark Zeeman sublevels. And instead of falling back to the original state and being able to scatter more photons, you're always, two-thirds of the time, falling into dark states that you have to somehow bring back into the cycle. So at least three routes have been identified for dealing with this problem. The one that we use is simply to apply a transverse magnetic field so that these dark states Larmor process back into the bright state. Technique that we talked about and now Junyi's group has employed is to rapidly switch the laser polarization so that if you fall here, you switch the laser and repump out of there. That's been demonstrated to work. And then the idea that was originally talked about in this Stuhl et al. Paper was to use a resonant electric field. They talked about the case of close-lying omega doublets and a DC field, but you can always do it with a microwave field to repump population from one level to another. So that fixes this problem, but it comes at a cost. And that is that having these extra levels in the cycling transition leads to a reduced scattering rate. So here's the basic idea. Suppose you have a real two-level system as you have in the cycling transition of an alkali atom. Then the maximum scattering rate is one-half the spontaneous emission rate of this state. That's the best you can do is if you're rapidly Rabi cycling between these two levels, half the time your population is in the excited level, and half the time it's scattering photons from there. But in a condition like the one that I showed on the previous slide, if you're cycling on a J equals 1 to J equals 0 transition, because you have these dark sublevels and you have to remix out of them, you must spend some of your time in these levels. And it's easy to convince yourself that the best you can do is to cycle so fast on all three of these optical cycling and remixing transitions that you spend an equal amount of time in all four of the sublevels involved in the cycle. And that slows down your scattering rate by a factor of 2. In our case, there's the additional problem that the V equals one state is connected to this via another optical transition. And that means the best you can do is to equalize the population over 7 sublevels so that we reduce the scattering rate by another factor of a few. And you can see where this is going. If you have n ground state sublevels involved in the cycle and only one excited state level, you reduce your population by a factor of 1 over n plus 1, or reduce your excited state population and therefore your scattering rate by 1 over n plus 1. And this piles up in a hurry. This was, by the way, I think, to my knowledge, first pointed out for the case of atomic indium by Dieter Meschede's group. So the point is that the cooling or slowing forces, which are proportional to the photon scattering rate, are reduced for these molecular systems versus atoms by factors of at least a few. I'll also point out that in practice, despite having really pushed pretty hard on this, we've never been able to get our scattering rate more than about half of the theoretical maximum. We've never understood exactly why that is. Okay, so now let me tell you a little bit more specifically about strontium fluoride. Again, the basic idea is that we're cycling on a J equals 1 to J equals 0 transition to the lowest excited state, which is a pi 1/2 state. In reality, strontium fluoride is complicated. It has an unpaired electron spin and an unpaired nuclear spin of a half on the fluorine. This gives rise to spin rotation and hyperfine structure, which is small compared to the rotational splitting. You can see the scale here is about 100 megahertz. This scale is 15 gigahertz. But nevertheless, we are able to cycle on this transition by hitting all four of these transitions, sublevel, hyperfine sublevel transitions, with different frequencies derived from the same laser. And again, we use a transverse magnetic field for mixing the dark Zeeman sublevels that appear in this system. In practice, we're sort of lucky. It turns out that if you take a carrier frequency here and you modulate it with an electro-optic modulator at a single frequency, you get sidebands as shown here, which just happen to line up pretty well with all four of the hyperfine transitions. It's just an experimental convenience for strontium fluoride. But I'll point out that because of the way we do this, we really, it's hard to define a detuning the way you do for laser cooling of atoms. Because we actually have lots of detunings here, lots of frequencies and lots of molecular lines. We basically have only two knobs. One is the frequency of the carrier, and the other is the frequency of the sidebands. And those two knobs are really controlling, depending on how you count, 4 or even 8 or more detunings in the system. So it's a little hard to get a handle on exactly what to expect from such a large parameter space. Okay, so our first results in laser cooling were published a couple of years ago in Nature. We took one of these slow cryogenic beams of molecules, in this picture traveling from left to right. We worked on transversely cooling the velocity of this beam. We used cooling beams, both a cycling laser and two vibrational repumping lasers that were multipassed to go back and forth and provide momentum transfer both from the top down and from the bottom up to the molecules. We monitor what's happening to the molecules by imaging fluorescence from the molecular beam on an ICCD camera. And really the key point here is because of the slowdown of the scattering rate due to the multiple ground sublevels in the cycling, we had to have really quite a long interaction region in order to get enough cooling force for enough time to get an observable effect. So we set this up with the laser bounce back and forth about 100 times over a region about 15 centimeters long to maximize the interaction time. And here are results from this. The black curve is a molecular beam transverse spatial profile with no cooling applied. The red curve is a molecular beam transverse spatial profile when we applied lasers on average detuned to the red by about a natural line width with a magnetic field optimized so the Larmor frequency is about the same as the natural line width. And this is classic Doppler cooling. So these are unrescaled raw data. You can see that all the way out to the edge of our molecular beam distribution, there's evidence of cooling. This is consistent with a capture range of about 4 meters per second. That's roughly what you would expect for Doppler cooling under our conditions. And the estimated temperature at the end of this, based on a comparison to a Monte Carlo, was about 5 millikelvin. And here we believe this was limited just by the length of time we had to interact. We haven't hit any fundamental cooling limit. We just ran out of time to apply cooling forces to the molecules as they flew through the region. We also saw Sisyphus effect cooling. Here we saw this when we deliberately aligned the lasers so there were standing waves. We deliberately applied a smaller magnetic field, and as was worked out 20 odd years ago by folks like Claude Cohen-Tanucci and Hal Metcalf and several others, for this sort of J to J minus one transition, this gives rise to a particular sort of Sisyphus force, where contrary to what we're used to for a closed two-level system or for an alkali atom at least, here, because of the J to J minus one nature of the transition, blue detuning leads to very strong cooling, but only in a narrow velocity range. Outside that narrow range, you actually get Doppler heating. So you can see this here. For higher velocities, we get a little bit of heating because the distribution spreads out. For small velocities, we get deep cooling as the velocity compresses. And this gave us an estimated temperature of about 300 microkelvin, again, limited just by interaction time, we believe. And this has the interesting feature, this particular sort of Sisyphus force, that if you red detune, you again get cooling in the wings of the distribution, but you actually get heating out to a finite fixed point of velocity to give a velocity profile that looks roughly like this. And this all agreed with relatively crude but realistic simulations. So we then went on to see if we can apply laser forces not just to cool the transverse motion, but to slow the longitudinal motion. So again, we take our molecular beam. Now we hit it with counterpropagating beams, a cycling laser and two repumping lasers. The forward velocity of our cryogenic beam here was about 150 meters per second. It takes about 20,000 photon recoils to stop a strontium fluoride molecule in this beam. But according to our calculations, we should be able to scatter 100,000 without loss. And at our observed scattering rate, which is about half the maximum rate, it takes about 70 centimeters to stop. It turns out that in order to do the slowing, we ended up using what's the analog of white light slowing for atoms. That is, we deliberately broaden the spectrum of our laser with many, many sidebands from an electro-optic modulator so that it covers Doppler shifts corresponding all the way from the maximum initial velocity of the molecules down to nearly zero velocity. And the idea here is that this gives us a larger velocity capture range. I'll just point out something that I get asked a lot, which is, why don't you just use a Zeeman slower like everyone uses for atoms because it works so well? And the reason is that it's really impractical and I might even say impossible to do this for molecules. And the problem is that our cycling transition, this 1-to-0 transition, gives a rapid redistribution of population among the different Zeeman sublevels, which have opposite signs or zero Zeeman shift. So the way a Zeeman slower works is you apply a shape B magnetic field so that the Zeeman shift cancels the Doppler shift as you change the velocity during slowing. But you can only do this for one sublevel. So imagine you've got some Doppler shift versus position for constant acceleration. You create a magnetic field to match that so that the difference between the Doppler shift and the Zeeman shift is zero. That's great for one of these sublevels. But the other sublevels actually do exactly the wrong thing. They get shifted out of resonance. Right, that's why we use this white light slowing method rather than Zeeman slowing. So here's typical data. This shows some velocity distributions in the longitudinal directions. The black is again control unperturbed beam. Then as we change the detuning of the slowing laser, which again has a broad frequency spread, many components, at the top it's actually shifted off to the right, mostly shifted off to the right of the diagram. And then we tune the laser so that the central value of the spectrum comes more and more in resonance with the molecules and then even goes beyond it. And what we see is that the velocity distribution shifts to lower velocities. As we change the detuning, the peak of the velocity distribution shifts lower and lower until we go too far. We see that we can, if we use as a measure of the of how much we move the velocity, where the half maximum edge is, we can move that by as much as 60 meters per second, meaning that we've scattered 10,000 photons. We see a significant number of molecules below about 50 meters per second, where there were really almost none in the original beam. And not surprisingly, these different laser detunings give different degrees of slowing, but they also give a different apparent loss. You can see that the area under this peak is going down as we push the velocity distribution down. We spent a lot of time investigating why that is. We were paranoid that we were losing molecules to states outside the cycling transition. But it turns out that the loss of population was really just due to the fact that the molecular beam diverges more and more as you slow it down. It has some finite divergence. As you go slower and slower, the divergence gets bigger and bigger. And ultimately, if you succeed in slowing it down, then it'll never hit your detector. So to convince ourselves of that, we did lots of experimental tests and then did a simulation showing in black the control velocity profiles, in gray the estimated force profile given our laser spectrum and this maximum scattering rate. And we were able to predict velocity distributions in the colors here, and you can see qualitatively it matches extremely well with our data. So this Monte Carlo prediction, assuming that the only loss is due to the divergence and the molecules slow down, agrees quite well with our data. So since then, we've spent the last year or so building up an apparatus to take our slow beam and trap it. And we're first going to start trying to trap it in a magneto-optic trap, though there are other possibilities if for some reason the MOT doesn't work. But we'll focus for the moment on the MOT. Because we lose so much of our beam down at the end of the beam line due to this divergence, we've also been thinking about how to increase our slow flux for trap loading. So, for example, by applying transverse cooling at the same time we're slowing the beam. And this, but just to give you a sense, this is the MOT apparatus. You can see the MOT coils over here. You can see one of the two tables filled with lasers. I had hoped that we would be looking for a MOT last week, but one of our lasers died, so maybe this week. At any rate, this is something that we set up a little while ago. We had our slowing lasers set up just as before and a transverse cooling region set up more or less as before, but with an even longer cooling region to try to get more cooling force or cooling force applied over a longer time. And what we quickly realized from data, and then realized we should have understood it from the start, is that because the cooling and slowing are both forces from spontaneous photon scattering, there's a fixed total spontaneous scattering rate, and therefore there's a competition between the forces for slowing and cooling. And I know June and Matt Hummann have seen this as well in their experiments. So the bottom line is, if we take a beam and we slow it, we get some velocity profile. If we now apply transverse cooling, we do see some improvement in our slow flux due to transverse cooling. And in particular, there's now clearly visible population down below 20 or even 10 meters per second, which is probably slow enough to capture in our trap. But we had expected more before we realized there was going to be competition between these two effects. And the bottom line is that this transverse cooling helps, but it doesn't help as much as you might hope. We had hoped for a factor of 4 or 5 from this, and instead we get a factor of 1.5 or so. So that's led us to think about different ways to deliver more slow molecules to a trap, and this is something we've been working on as we've been building the MOT apparatus. So again, the primary problem is just that the beam divergence increases as you slow it down. Its transverse velocity remains the same while its longitudinal velocity gets lower and lower, the divergence angle increases. So it occurred to us that it would be lovely if while we're slowing the molecules, we could keep them confined. So that we're not changing their transverse velocity, but we're keeping them from leaving as we slow them down. And then once you've done that, once they're slow, it's much easier to transversely cool them. The low scattering rates isn't its bigger problem once the molecules are moving slowly. So we thought for a while how to do this. It's not quite trivial, but we've now come up with an approach that we believe will work, which is based on using microwave forces to guide. So the idea is, here's the ground state of our cycling transition. Sorry, that should be m equals plus 1 there. And we'll apply a microwave field that's detuned to the blue of a transition to the next excited rotational level. Of course, this is inspired by the work Melanie Schnell and Harold Meyer led, where they demonstrated microwave guiding with ammonia molecules. And the key point about microwaves, in contrast with DC electric fields or DC magnetic fields, is that all of these states for this transition are low field seekers, weak field seekers. For a DC electric field or a DC magnetic field, some of the sublevels that you're constantly shuffling between due to the optical cycle will be anti-guided and some will be guided. Whereas for the microwave, this sort of microwave-based force, all of these sublevels get guided. And it turns out, if you put in the numbers, they all feel a potential depth which is roughly equal, within about 20% of each other. So not only are they guided, but they're all guided by about the same, with about the same force. So the state redistribution, Zeeman sublevel redistribution from the optical cycling transition is really no problem for guiding with this sort of force. And just for the experts in the field, it turns out that having the microwaves on screws up the optical cycle. So the idea is to alternate between slowing and guiding, turning the slowing lasers on, the guiding microwave field on alternately. So our microwave design uses a T01 mode in a cylindrical cavity. This has a zero electric field at the guide center and then linearly increasing away from it. Here's a picture of what our molecules in a transverse guide would look like. We've got a guide on the bench now that gives about a 10 millikelvin guide depth corresponding to a 1 meter per second transverse velocity. And a bigger amplifier will give us more guide depth. Here's what the thing looks like. This is a short prototype cavity. Ultimately, this one's about 18 inches long. We'll ultimately have one that's about a meter long. And this actually matches what you do for a Jackson homework problem remarkably well. All right, so the last thing I'll just quickly say is we've also been thinking about ways to apply optical slowing forces instead of using photon scattering to use some stimulated or coherent processes. And of course, there are some known examples of this, like bichromatic force slowing that was demonstrated by Rudy Grimm and Hal Metcalf. Ed Eiler's proposed to do this for diatomic molecules. Also, Peter Barker's group has some beautiful results using optical Stark deceleration. And we have a variant on this that we've been thinking about that we call force Sisyphus slowing. The idea is you apply to the molecular beam an intense longitudinal standing wave, which is blue detuned, far enough away that it doesn't actually cause any photon scattering. It just gives a periodic potential that's very, very deep. Then if you apply a traveling wave repump, which is resonant at the nodes of the standing wave field, it causes optical pumping such that the molecules have to ride up a potential hill. Then when they spontaneously decay, they always find themselves they rarely find themselves at the maximum. They often find themselves near the minimum, where they again have to climb a potential well. But the point is that all of these stimulated or coherent forces need a very high laser intensity over a very large area in order to efficiently slow a molecular beam. So we thought a bit about how the forces, these sort of stimulated forces, how do they scale with things like laser power and detuning? It turns out it's always true if you pick the optimal detuning, the force is proportional to the Rabi frequency or the square root of the intensity. And over some time t, the change in velocity is proportional to the force times the time. So that's proportional to the time, the inverse area, and the energy, total laser energy felt by the molecules over that time. So if you look at this scaling, you conclude that you want pulses with lots of energy for a long time, if you want to do it over a fixed large area. And we started thinking about what if we could make a laser with 100 millijoules of energy, which is typical for a pulse laser, with a time of 100 microseconds and an area of a centimeter squared. This has an instantaneous power of a kilowatt, but it gives you forces that are 100 times bigger than spontaneous forces. And therefore, you can reduce the number of scattered photons by 100-fold. So we're building a laser like this right now. Finally, I'll just quickly mention one of the reasons, one of our motivations for this is that we are thinking about laser cooling a new species, thallium fluoride. This is based on work we did in collaboration with Larry Hunter's group. Thallium fluoride has possible application to measurement of the Schiff moment, which is, for those who don't know this story, like the nuclear analog of the electron EDM. And everything looks good for this, except the cycle is not as closed as it is for strontium fluoride. So we'd like to be able to not have to scatter as many photons. Okay, just point out the work was done by lots of folks in my group, particularly John Berry, who is the grad student who led most of the laser cooling results that I told you about. And I'll just wrap up there. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. The floor is open for question and discussion. Jamie.
Lovely results, Dave. So I'm trying to understand how general this is, and you mentioned a couple of dozen molecules that have the right Frank Condon factors. But one thing I didn't quite understand during your talk was what the role of hyperfine coupling was going to be in a couple of different circumstances. The first was at the beginning you talked about this factor of 7 or whatever it is.
Right.
And at that point you were counting hyperfine free M levels as far as I can see.
That's right.
And I wonder why. And the second was that later on when you were talking about the microwave guiding, I wondered whether the intensity and therefore the microwave shifts, the AC Stark shifts, were actually going to be the same for the different hyperfine components.
Right. So with regards to the first question, I'm not sure that I have an extremely general answer to the first question, but at least in the case of strontium fluoride, if you do the state counting, let's say you ignore spin rotation and hyperfine, you ignore all the spins. It looks like an n equals 1 to n equals 0, there's 3 and 1. When you add the electron spin, you double the number of states here, but you also double the number of states in n equals 0 to j equals half. Then when you add the nuclear spin of a half, you again multiply the number of states by 2 in both the ground state and excited state. So the counting ends up being the same. At least in this particular case where you're not resolving the upper state hyperfine levels. That splitting is small compared to the natural lifetime. In general, I can imagine cases where the hyperfine structure is such that you might only, in the excited state, excite one of those hyperfine levels, if that splitting were big, for example, and then you'd have to modify the counting. In the end, the scattering rate is going to be determined by the number of excited state levels in the cycle divided by the number of ground states plus 1. That'll determine your scattering rate compared to the natural width of the excited state. The second question was for the microwave transition. Well, actually, this is helpful. So for the microwave transition, under the conditions that we're working under, are the Rabi frequency associated with a microwave trapping dry field will be comparable to or slightly bigger than the spin rotation and hyperfine splittings, which is another way of saying the microwaves don't resolve the spin rotation and hyperfine structure.
They may not resolve it, but surely different transitions have different intensities.
Well, they do, and yet if you go through and think about there's a sum rule that says that if you add up all the intensities for unresolved transitions, it's as if you never had the structure that gave rise, the extra structure like spins that gave rise to the structure that you're not resolving. In fact, of course, we put in the real numbers and check, and there are minor differences between the levels. if the Rabi frequency were small compared to these splittings, then it would be a serious issue. Yeah.
Back here. Yeah, very impressive indeed. Maybe even following up on this last point and merging this into a question I had before is, I mean, you surely have considered using a off-resonant laser field to the focusing instead of the microwave field, which has advantages and disadvantages regarding power and regarding actually volume, actually geometric volume, which you can tackle. So I was wondering what actually your standpoint on the volume is. But it would also, to some extent, avoid the question that Jeremy was just asking, because if you go to an off-resonant gradient force, essentially, then, of course, the levels will behave practically the same.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And right, I think in principle, absolutely, you can think of our microwave field as in every way the analog of an optical field, except that you never have to think about spontaneous emission. But the other thing, right, you don't have to think about spontaneous emission so that you can detune as close as you want without having to worry about photon scattering. But also, you can get a boatload of power in the microwave region. And resonant cavities are so easy that even we were able to make one in a matter of weeks with, you know, really no experience dealing with microwaves. So to give you a sense, inside our microwave cavity, the intracavity built-up field has a power on the order of a megawatt. And it's hard to do that over a large volume with a laser beam. So our microwave field, you know, is going to confine molecules over a diameter of roughly a centimeter. So it's simply very hard to get that deep a trap over that large a volume using a laser beam.
Exactly. My question was actually, my original question was more, which volume do you want? I mean, all your other experiments are lasers, but they're relatively low power. So, I mean, you know, if you want to go for 100 micron beam, then of course the laser might be much easier to get high intensities.
Yeah, that's right.
But of course, if you want to work over millimeters, then I totally buy your microwave argument.
Yeah, that's right. And the answer is we want to work over the biggest volume we can because we can get more molecules. Obviously, it scales with the area. So, you know, technologically, to have things that are on the order of a few millimeters to a centimeter is a good match, for example, with the typical volume of a mod. If you start to go down to things like 100 microns, you're throwing away lots of perfectly good molecules.
Dave, I have two fairly quick questions, one about slowing and one about trapping.
Yep.
You've explained these all optical methods very nicely. I know Stephen Hoekstra is building a decelerator. You commented briefly on the decelerator. So the differences between slowing versus by all optical and optical microwave methods versus the decelerators, could you just comment, is it only the weak field difference, weak field seeking state difference that you see as the major difference between those? What are the major differences or prospects for those two? And then the question about trapping is, if you can get a three-dimensional MOT, what kind of trap would you think of loading these into? Would it just be an ordinary dipole trap, or do you have some ideas about trapping of the strontium fluoride? Thank you.
Right. So with regards to optical slowing versus stark deceleration, it's a complicated many-parameter problem. It's hard to say in a very general way. I'll just say that optical slowing, it's at least optical slowing where you're really scattering photons like we are. In principle, you know, we've demonstrated that we can do this over a large phase space volume of our initial molecules. So a decelerator will often grab some chunk of the initial phase space of the molecular beam and slow that down. Now, the fraction of the original phase space that it's catching is getting better and better all the time. But in principle, our slowing really, really addresses the entire initial phase-based distribution of the molecules coming out of our beam. I didn't emphasize it here, but we've seen, and it's sort of intuitively obvious, that the optical slowing can also be combined with some longitudinal cooling as well. It's not trivial, but we've seen some evidence of it, and we have some ideas for how to make it better. And of course, the stark deceleration is purely conservative. I think it's hard to compare apples to apples because I think the question is going to be for strontium, something like strontium fluoride, for example, with a start decelerator apparatus, what fraction of the phase-based density can you get into the decelerator and decelerate versus what fraction can we decelerate in an apparatus like this? I suspect the answer is going to be very different for different species. Right. So I forget, was the second question? Right, so we're going to start with an ordinary MOT. I'll point out that it's not 100% clear how an ordinary MOT works on a transition like this, where the Zeeman shifts actually do the opposite of what you want them to do. But experimentally, it seems to work for alkali atoms, so we'll try it. After that, I think it's going to, where we go from there will depend on what sort of phase-based density we get in the MOT. If the phase-based density turns out to be high enough, then the obvious thing would be to go to an optical trap. But I have to say, we're thinking these days a lot about magnetic traps based on the really stunning results from June's group, you know, stimulated by theory from John Bone's group, showing that evaporative cooling can work even for something as complicated as OH in a magnetic trap. I want to lock John Bone in a closet here and force him to tell me the answer that I think I know of whether we can do something analogous for strontium fluoride. So if you see him with bruises, yeah, this is excellent. He was telling me he was going to say something that caused me to flee his talk. So, it'll depend on what happens with the MOT.
Thanks for a great talk, Dave. I'd like to know about this whole sequence of molecular species. Can you flip back to that slide early on where you gave this wonderful list? And you said something in passing, perhaps I misunderstood you. You said something like, oh, we've tried all these in the lab.
Maybe I'm not.
Did I mishear you?
What are you referring to?
Well, you had O2 among other interesting molecules. You know. Yeah.
Oh,
and
right.
These are all the things that you could hope to laser
means,
cool.
Yeah.
And
When I say we, I mean the royal we, which mainly means John Doyle.
Okay, I understand
now.
I understand now. Okay.
No. Not laser cooling. Just creating these slow, intense molecular beams. Right.
Okay. Thank you. That clarifies a lot. And then the second question I had is, you showed this picture of phase-based density, but you never marked an X as to where your experiments actually sit on that plot. So can you nominally point to where they are right now? And
yeah, they're somewhere, you know, over there.
okay.
And the reason is, right now, we just have a beam. We don't have a trap. So once we get molecules... What?
Over here is like one molecule per cubic centimeter.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it's down there somewhere. But
okay.
The reason is we don't have a trap yet. So the question is really not terribly interesting until you get stuff in a trap. And hopefully I'll be able to tell you that very soon.
Thank you.
So let me ask one more. You actually mentioned the phrase phase-based density quite a number of times during your talk.
Yes.
But you didn't actually discuss the fraction of population per quantum state that's also part of phase-based density.
Sure.
And I mean, so your beams are on a few Kelvin level, which you start with. So you have actually quite a number of states populated, and that's something that also scales very unfavorably with, you know, going to heavier or larger molecules. So do you see any prospects on mitigating the issue of losing molecules because they're in the wrong quantum state, either by pumping them or maybe even by simultaneously decelerating them?
Yeah, so I have an answer that's so simple-minded it's almost stupid, but at least for diatomics, we have an EDM experiment using thorium oxide molecules, and one of the things we're doing there is what we call rotational cooling. Basically pumping out of all the rotational levels that are populated that we don't use, pump them into the level that we do use. And, you know, conceptually it sounds sexy, but in fact we get a factor of two or so in signal size from doing that. But still, it is a form of rotational cooling. I think, you know, in terms of this technology, aside from something fairly simple like that, I'm not sure there's anything obvious, although, you know, maybe the the techniques that have been pioneered by PA's group, you know, using broadband lasers, potentially could work, but it's the time scales are pretty long for something like that. So, and you still need some sort of quasi-cycling electronic transition. It's an interesting question, though. I think we don't have a broad answer to it, or I certainly don't.
Okay, I think it's time for the next speaker now. Let's thank Dave one more time. Also, I encourage the experimentalists in the audience to ask questions.
I thought we are here just to serve the need of the theorists.
No.
I think that's nice.
So for the next talk, we have Jingyi from JILA, and I guess you changed the title, did you?
I changed the title.
Okay. Originally, I guess you wanted to talk about three different beautiful experiments, but...
Lincoln Carr said that you should have a whip, that if I go over time, and I know that Kang Kun will do that in the lab, I have experience there. So anyway. He wanted me to stay in 30 minutes, and I want to do that, so I want to talk just one thing. That's why I changed the title.
Great.
But so, Dave also gave a great introduction. So.
Right.
Thanks, Kang Kun.